Hello and welcome to Conversations About Alcohol, a chance to step back from the coalface of general practice and learn from others on how to improve and inform our chats with patients about the harms of alcohol. Hello, I'm really pleased to be joined today by Catriona Patterson, a clinical nurse manager who works in primary care, mental health and substance use. Kat, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you, Rachel. It was a pleasure to be here.
I really was keen to get you in for really a discussion about practical issues and tips that we can use to improve our everyday consultations in primary care. But I know that you've also done some very interesting research, and I think that would be a helpful place to start to consider the overall context of this work.
Certainly, and we can move on to looking at the sort of practicalities of consultations. But I did an MSc in neuroscience a couple of years ago and chose to do a dissertation on the relationship between adverse childhood experiences and mental health. And what was really interesting is I wanted to look at whether there was a difference between the type, the timing, and the duration of adverse childhood experiences and the risk of mental health issues, which would include substance use. What I found, though, and the dissertation, as they often do, took a turn, was that actually there was very little research, really nothing conclusive, nothing that you could base any kind of results that were meaningful. And when I explored that, I found that actually there were two key issues with looking at trauma. One was a reticence to ask patients about it. So there was a huge amount of fear. A lot of work was done in Australia around this work about asking about trauma, about the risk that they might upset the patient, they might classically open a can of worms, but also what do I do if this patient then discloses? How do I fix it? The enormity of it. And I mean, I think that's even more important in general practice when you're so time pressured.
Yes.
So the reason we don't have the research and we're not moving forward is that people are still quite frightened about asking about it. And then the other bit that was really vague and really hadn't got a lot of clarity is what actually is trauma-informed practice. And we've come a little bit of a way, but what I found really interesting is that really mixed messages when you ask professionals and professionals that had worked in mental health and substance use for a long time, very vague about what trauma-informed practice looked like. But when you ask patients and patients who had experiences of trauma, they knew exactly what it looked like. And it was simple and it was practical and it was implementable, which was really quite a game changer. So that was my research. As I say, the conclusion in the research was that we need to support professionals to have the I suppose the confidence to ask, to reassure them that actually what the research did say, and this was really conclusive, is that nobody was offended by being asked. If they hadn't had a history of trauma, they weren't offended at all. But more interestingly, if they were asked and they disclosed, nobody expected you to fix it. Nobody needed the magic answers. What they said is it was like people recognizing that elephant in the room, and it was validating and it showed care and interest. And that's actually what came out of what trauma-informed practice looks like from a patient point of view.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that feeling of, crikey, do I really want to open up this consult and think about childhood adverse events and trauma when I have absolutely no idea what to do about it, or time or resources or energy. So that's quite helpful to hear that folk with trauma are smart enough, they know you're not going to suddenly solve their trauma, they actually just appreciate it being recognised. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely, absolutely. Just appreciating that they may well have gone through difficult life experiences, and they may well, and I say may well, have an impact on their life today, on their relationships, on their function, on their mood.
Yeah.
And I say may because we don't know what it is exactly that I suppose someone with trauma goes on to lead a very successful, very fulfilling life without substance use, and the difference for those that unfortunately really struggle.
Kat, if you don't mind me asking, what do you mean by trauma-informed care? Could you give me some practical examples?
Yes, absolutely. So it is a term that does have a lot of ambiguity and confusion. Mm. But going back to research where we asked patients who had experienced trauma, it really boils down to a feeling of empowerment and control, because that's what you lose when you're abused. Mm-hmm. And the practical ways, the first thing I would say is I will jointly write notes and referrals with patients.
Okay.
Not word for word,
but
I will sit and say, I'm going to write this. I quite like to include this. Do you feel comfortable me putting this into your notes or into the referral? Is there anything you think is really important to cover?
Yeah, okay.
Would it be helpful for me to mention that you would like a trauma-informed approach, or would you rather not?
Okay, yeah.
So it's all about choice.
Yeah.
And then the other really important thing that I do with patients, and we have to do this in mental health particularly because the appointments we have are fairly short in primary care.
Yeah.
But it's actually really good to say to a patient, we've got 10 minutes or 15 minutes this morning, so it's really important we cover what is a priority for you.
Mm-hmm.
But we may well both go off on tangents, so I will let you know when you've got 5 minutes left of your consult so that we can get to a point where there is a natural conclusion. Because what you find is patients start to warm up and they disclose, and then you're in a situation where you're either going to run right over.
Yes.
And I don't know about you, but as soon as I know I'm running over, I'm not.
Get stressed.
Yeah, I'm stressed. Yeah. And it shows. And I can see the lines being ticked in and more patients. So that's not a good place for me to be.
Yeah.
But it's also not good to cut somebody off.
No.
So actually, by saying, we've got 5 minutes left, it's really important we come to some conclusion that you leave here feeling safe and heard.
That's very helpful. Two practical tips about how to make. I was thinking, you know, trauma-informed was always asking permission before touching the patient, that kind of thing. But I can see that it's really also about maybe being interactive with what you write in the referral together or in the notes together, giving them some authorship.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's also being quite clear about the time so you don't end up being abrupt at the end or letting them sort of start to get into something and then feel a bit dismissed.
Yeah, I mean, you're really creating a sense of safety and inclusion, which are the two missing factors when you experience abuse.
Yes.
So you're creating an environment. Effectively, a trauma-informed practice is not creating an environment that feels traumatic in any way. And so you're looking at psychological safety, and that is about just informed choices, writing things together, coming up with plans together, keeping the time measured. But if you get the time as well, there might be some specifics because trauma is all very personal.
Yes.
It's all very, very unique.
Yeah.
And it might be a word or a phrase or something that is really hurtful or triggering.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, asking permission to say to the, can I put that in your notes?
Mm-hmm.
Can I put, please avoid using this word?
Mm-hmm.
So that my other colleagues can also respect your wishes.
I'm just thinking, I recently upset a patient because I didn't have a phone slot. I just had a medication acute slot for a prescription, but I needed to ring her to clarify something. But I was already rushed for time. And of course, I didn't want it to be a full big conversation, which I knew it might open up into. And so I was quite rushed and what she told me afterwards felt very dismissive. I suppose I'm thinking about how to apologise for that, and then how we can move forward from that. Is that helpful in trauma informed? Is it about acknowledging when you've got it wrong as well?
Yes, it's about being human. Mm. But I would go a little bit further and maybe just be more honest and transparent right at the start. So. Mm-hmm. I have regularly rang a patient and said, look, I had to deal with an emergency today. I cannot give you the full time, but I do want to check in. But we've only maybe got a few minutes.
Yeah.
And if anything we do, we book some more time.
Yes.
Because I think trauma-informed, just keep thinking, trauma-informed practice is about having the knowledge and control over the situation.
Yes, and in retrospect, thinking about that situation, she wasn't expecting a phone call. I rang her out the blue and then proceeded to rush her. And didn't really explain that until the end, when it started to grow arms and legs. And then I said, look, I've got lots of patients, I'm busy. So I can see how if I'd sort of either thought not to ring her when I was in a rush, or to say from the outset of our call, look, this is just a quick question, that might have helped.
I think it might. We still get it wrong. Of course,
yes.
We get it wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that the power of apology is massive.
Yeah.
But certainly in health service as well, when something goes wrong, we really want to really create a learning culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be done at an individual level as well. So mm-hmm. saying, look, I did this with my best intentions, but I wasn't clear, I rang you out of the blue, then I put myself under pressure, then
yeah.
I put you under pressure.
Yeah.
So what I've learned is I'm going to be honest about this going forward, or
yeah.
I'm not going to use that slot. And
yeah.
and I think that's even more powerful, because the patient thinks, well, you're not just saying sorry in a kind of tokenistic way.
Yeah.
You've actually taken on board what went wrong, and
yeah.
you're going to make some changes.
In fact, after we last met, I sort of tried that out in a consult, and I asked a patient who'd come to me who'd been in and out of hospital in DTs, and I did, just bearing in mind what you'd said, I said something like, what do you think led you down this path, you know, in the first place? And he did look a bit surprised to be asked about that, and it did lead to quite a fruitful conversation. It didn't solve the issue, but I think it was slightly transformative for both of us, because his elephant in the room was being recognised. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you also did inadvertently was shift that power dynamic that I think we need to be aware as professionals does exist.
Right.
And the fact that you were talking to him at his level about
mm.
his life, showing
mm.
that understanding
mm.
is actually really powerful
okay.
for any kind of health management.
Okay, yeah. And I suppose we should say here, Kat, that we're not saying all addiction is driven by trauma, and that all people who struggle with addiction must have had some traumatic past. We're not saying that, but we are saying that it is something worth considering.
Yes, absolutely. No, the last thing we want to do is lump another level of stigma onto someone who's struggling with an addiction.
Yeah.
Because the reality is that adverse childhood experiences and abuse are very secretive and hidden often, and there is a lot of stigma. So no, what I'm saying is don't make that automatic connection at all.
Yeah.
It's more just being aware when you're in consult, and I mean repeatedly with people who just seem stuck and are not moving forward and
mm.
really, really struggling, that it might be something you might want to invite in conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as doctors, you need to remember that you will trust your instincts when that is right,
mm-hmm.
but look for the clues as well, because
mm-hmm.
actually patients may well be giving you clues. I can remember a patient particularly saying, I don't know that I'm ever going to stop drinking. After all, everybody in my family drank, and
mm-hmm.
they drank when I grew up, and they drank in a really harmful way. And that was an invitation.
Mm-hmm. And so what you would sort of encourage us to do is to then, how would we ask about trauma? Would you just say, what do you think's driving it? Or would you be a bit more explicit? Would you ask, did things happen to you as a child, or how would you go about it?
So I am really open-ended, because I think this is a good question to ask any patient anyhow, is I tend to say, I'd like to get to know a little bit more about you, some of your experiences in your life and where we might be able to tap in going forward. Mm-hmm. Would you be happy telling me a little bit about what life was like growing up?
Okay.
And that really gives the power back to the patient. You're not asking if things went wrong. You're just asking what life was like.
I like that. That's a very specific, practical. Thank you. You know, and another thing that came out of talking to you over the last year, Kat, is I realised that although I thought I was well-intended and empathetic, I actually have a massively doctor-driven agenda with patients. You know, I've sort of decided in my head that abstinence is the only way forward, and so I just need to make that very clear. And I've been really quite dogmatic about that. And talking to you with all your experience of working in this field over many years, I realised that I need to somehow let that go more and let the patient lead. I wonder if you could say a little bit about that, you know, about abstinence, but also about the kind of patient-led versus doctor-led.
I mean, I think for a start, Rachel, I wouldn't beat yourself up about that, because if we look at things from a real kind of medical perspective, we can see that some of the issues our patients are experiencing, the harm, whether it be social, psychological or medical, would be much quicker fixed with abstinence. Mm. But I guess I would suggest that might be like asking someone who sat on their couch to run a marathon.
Mm.
Now, I'm not saying people don't sit on their couches and then run marathons, but what's really important is that you don't frighten that patient off. Now, sometimes patients will come to you and they will invite the conversation around abstinence, but if they don't, it really has to be patient-led. And the kind of thing I would ask is, what might be the first step in terms of your drinking you'd like to look at? So don't even go down units, because they're a little bit arbitrary, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
It could be a behaviour, it could be a time, it could be a particular social contact, it could be anything.
Mm.
You're really tapping into where they see their drinking is most problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're working on that goal. Now, we know that controlled drinking has its risks in terms of relapse. We also know that periods of abstinence and detox and then drinking again actually cause more harm neurologically. But we do know that there are a cohort of patients who manage controlled drinking very well. We just don't see them again. So they're not statistically reliable.
Yeah.
For a start. But the other thing is, if somebody wants to work on a kind of controlled drinking, a plan, it sounds awful, but you may well be very suspicious that that's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
But we all need to, I guess, learn our own life lessons.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And sadly, in addiction especially, people need to get to a point where they feel that they've tried every other option and it is abstinence. And then they've got the power and motivation to do it. But if you turn around and somebody who is just beginning to think about their drinking and suggests they never drink again, there's a good chance you'll just frighten them off.
Yeah, I mean, that does make sense. It's just, I always think, gosh, you know, human nature, it's just so much easier to be all or nothing. And I just really want them to, you know, to realise that. But I can see that my impatience is really kind of, yeah, trying to sort of take control of it. And actually, it's not going to work much better if it comes from the patient.
Absolutely. And it, as I say, it comes from a good place
when
we want abstinence for our patients.
Yeah.
But what we also know is that if people don't actually work on their addiction and look at coping mechanisms and triggers, then it's quite common to swap addictions.
Mm-hmm.
So that happened a lot when I worked in sort of substance use with people experiencing heroin issues, that they would abstain, they would get onto methadone and abstain from heroin use, but would start drinking heavily.
Mm.
because you're mm-hmm. not actually changing that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can do that work with abstinence, but you can also do that work through controlled drinking mm-hmm. or even having conversations about drinking.
Mm.
So
I think that's quite been a big turnaround for me, that to even realize that there's lots of different goals that you could have. You know, I'm ultimately wanting recovery, full recovery and abstinence, but that's not going to work for everybody. And valuing other goals, I think, has been quite a game changer for me. So, and letting the patient set those goals, is that really the main?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right, human beings are a bit all or nothing. Mm. So if you set a goal of I'm never going to drink again, and you have a glass of wine one night, there's every chance that you'll just throw that goal out the window mm. and go back to harmful drinking.
I see, yeah.
So you can see how you're setting people's sights too high for yeah. some. For yeah. some, as I say, please don't ignore when yeah. people say I want abstinence, because
yeah.
that's great,
yeah.
but it has to come from them.
Yeah.
And then if you set realistic goals, and you in substance use, it's all about celebrating the small wins.
Yeah.
Because what you're giving someone is an opportunity to take back charge of their life.
Yeah. yeah.
And actually coming to you and saying, look, Rachel, I worked on this plan. I've only drank 3 times in the last month. I've been doing it in a social occasion that I'm comfortable and safe. I'm limiting it. You know, that might be recovery for them. That might be it.
Yeah.
You know, you just don't know.
That's been a big change, hearing that from you, from what I was thinking. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about is, you know, I'm in awe of the fact that you work in this day in, day out. And I'm just wondering, like, you know, because at least I have, you know, other types of consults as well, which is a nice change from these things. And I'm wondering how you cope when, you know, you're tired, you're stressed, and you're low on empathy and you feel exasperated. You know, I've certainly had patients where I just feel really quite exasperated. I suppose I'm upset to see them stuck, and I sometimes take it out on them.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that? Because that surely must happen to you.
Oh, absolutely. I remember starting this model many years ago and GP colleagues knocking on my door at the end of the day to see if I was okay, because this is what's all I was doing.
Yeah.
But this is my speciality. I think it's actually very simple. Be human
mm-hmm.
And be honest and transparent.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that and still show kindness and care. And it's the kindness and care that we don't want to lose
mm-hmm.
in consults.
Mm-hmm.
So I will regularly say to patients, I don't know about you, but I'm feeling really stuck. I'm feeling a little bit exasperated, not at you, but at where we are. So you're sharing the problem
okay.
as well. You're
yep.
not pinning the problem on them.
Yeah.
I'm almost out of ideas, but two heads are better than one. Do you feel like this? Actually saying to the patient, are you feeling stuck? Are you feeling a bit exasperated?
Mm-hmm.
Because patients very much will want to dump it all on you
mm-hmm.
and you sort it out. But actually putting that back and saying, are you in a good place? Or are you feeling a little bit that this is not going anywhere? So you're starting a conversation where you've got some shared understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And what you actually find is you get a real warmth from a patient because you're human, you mm-hmm. know, for a start.
Yeah.
And you feel and experience things. And the fact that you are feeling and experiencing things means that you care.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
know?
You're frustrated for
yeah,
them.
Yeah, if you didn't show any kindness or care, despite the fact that they'd spent another 4 weekends in A&E, in the police cells, you
mm-hmm.
know, on an assault charge or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and you didn't say anything, it's actually more harmful than saying, I saw another A&E report, my heart sank, I'm
yeah.
feeling frustrated. Are you feeling that too?
Yeah, that's it. That's helpful. And the other thing, thinking about, you know, why I've been so dogmatic about abstinence, is I've been thinking that, you know, people can't access counselling or emotional support until they stop drinking, even if it's the emotional problems that are maybe driving the
mm-hmm.
drinking. And I'm feeling like this sort of catch-22, speaking of exasperation, you know, that until someone gets sober, they can't get counselling, they need the counselling to get sober. But Again, you've challenged that narrative that I had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it doesn't make sense, does it?
No.
And I think we've gone through cycles in managing addiction over decades, and we've moved certainly in more opiate addictions from sort of abstinence to harm reduction and back and forward and back and forward. And I think to a certain extent we've done that with alcohol use as well. And then the psychological therapies have been driven by that. Obviously, you cannot enter into any kind of psychological therapy if you're intoxicated, mm-hmm. but that's very different from having an alcohol problem. So there are services out there, actually, Rachel. You do find that we're the dominating service tends to be NA, AA, CA. But ELCA, for instance, mm-hmm. is a Lothian counselling service who will work with somebody who is struggling with alcohol, and they are not focusing on the alcohol. They are not interested in the units and when they're drinking and how they can stop. Mm-hmm. They're looking at the drivers behind the alcohol use. Mm-hmm. Smart recovery as well is not abstinence based, and that's for drugs and alcohol. And it's really quite CBT based. So if you've got someone who says, I'm not ready for abstinence, but I want to stick to a plan, but I'm wondering what I do in those high risk times, those triggers, then SMART's very much about teaching this sort of CBT skills. How do I manage those? But I would say there's another really important wave now, that there is actually a lot of online resources. So there are NHS Inform, information, Drink Aware is very good as well. And then there are a couple of sort of more commercial apps that you would have to pay for. The one that I suppose I lean into most, again from my neuroscience background, is an app called Reframe. And it's about £70 a year, and it's mostly American driven, but it's got a huge UK population now. But you are expected to do daily programs, read information around the neuroscience of alcohol, look at coping mechanisms, keep a journal. It's got a peer interactive session, it's got webinars. It's really actually very comprehensive. I think it's really worth the money, if I'm honest with you. Because the other thing about going to groups, and I would say this more, if you've maybe got a background in health or social care, that there is a level of, it's difficult. Anonymity is difficult in Edinburgh. We're quite a small community. Now, I do know people that decide to go to groups in, say, West Lothian, because they live in East Lothian, but that relies on transport and time. So some people just feel that that isn't an option for them. So I think that's where the online stuff. The other thing is, if you are wanting abstinence, AA does an option to do online meetings. And they don't mind if you have your camera off at all. They're
Good. I can see how it could be a barrier to folk tapping into mutual aid if they think they have to go in person, and it's within their local community. So this idea that you could join an online community, keep your camera off, I could see how that could be a very helpful starting block for folk. I've just got to pick you up there. You mentioned Drink Aware. That isn't Drink Aware, the kind of organisation run by the alcohol industry, is it?
No.
That's a different one.
No, it's a different one.
I've just got to be careful about that, because at one point when I was making my webinar, I found such lovely infographics, which my boss kindly pointed out was made by Drink Aware, the alcohol industry. So we really don't want to signpost patients to that.
No, this is a different website.
Good.
Absolutely.
And I suppose we're hoping that GPs and nurses from throughout Scotland will be listening to this podcast. So the point really here is not about the specific resources that we mentioned, but the idea that actually in your area there will be resources that won't mandate abstinence before you can get help.
So certainly nationally, we have Turning Point Scotland and Change Grow Live. I know Change Grow Live I think, have a bigger presence in the north of England. I could be wrong. But but anyway, whatever your third sector therapeutic arm is in substance use, they will not be looking at abstinence necessarily as well. They will also be working with people at where they want to start and what they want to do. The biggie, I would say, for abstinence is your sort of 12 steps approach, which is NA, AA and CA.
And I think that's another thing you told me, is that the resources that you might end up, what we're calling sort of assertive signposting to, you know, that kind of really adding a little bit of weight when we say these, it's really important to engage with mutual aid. We know from evidence that this is the way that is most helpful. But when we're assertively signposting, I suppose where we signpost to would be influenced by the patient's sort of own perspective on their addiction, right? If they see it like a disease, or if they see it as a consequence of trauma, or could you say something a little bit about that? Because I think a lot of us GPs are really a bit clueless about all the different resources out there. We might not have thought about how your patient's perspective would influence which resource might suit them better.
And I think that's a really interesting question to ask a patient anyway, because they will have soul searched this for a very long time. People will have been living and managing with that these issues way before they come and see you. So they will be informed, and it does influence, absolutely. So, you know, AA, as I say, is abstinence, is a very clear disease model that you are go into recovery from that disease, but that disease never leaves you, and it needs constant vigilance and constant work. Now that works for some people, for some people that's the utter opposite, and that's where things like SMART and ELCA and other organizations. But actually I would go on to say it might not be necessarily a substance use service you signpost to. Try and understand why they drink. Is it anxiety, social anxiety? Is it sleep? That's a biggie. Is it a bereavement, effectively? There'd be a number of perhaps underlying things. And for some patients, they don't want substance use specialist services. So maybe saying, well, if you're drinking because you're anxious, let's tackle the anxiety. Let me signpost you to a few things. If you're not sleeping, let's look at your sleep hygiene. I mean, that's always a difficult one, sleep in general practice.
Yes, it is.
But there are apps. And there is, you know, you'd be surprised actually, and sleep is a big thing, how many myths there are around people sleeping. You know, who sleeps solidly for 8 hours? So I think it's having conversations around that. So I guess what I'm saying is talk about where they think their issues and the underlying factors are. Do they fall into a kind of nature nurture camp, which you know, mental health falls between in lots of ways, or actually is there something particular that they're pinpointing on? Did they start drinking when they lost their mum, or they lost their job, or they lost a pet even? You know, there's actually in Lothian online services for pet loss.
I can believe that.
So actually start, it goes back to what we were talking about right at the start. Start with where the patient's at.
That makes sense. Now, you mentioned that, you know, it's a sort of false narrative that you, while still actively drinking, you can't tackle your emotional problems. But of course, when someone's actively inebriated, you know, that's a different situation. And I wanted to ask you about that. I've had a few of my long-term patients attend clinic while still clearly drunk. And I really haven't quite known how to handle that, because I found that they don't tend to remember our conversations, and it feels like a waste of time, and it adds to my level of exasperation. Am I right to disengage at that point, or, you know, what would your guidance on that be?
I mean, it's a difficult one, and you do wonder what might be behind that. What I would say, Rachel, a really practical tip, having worked in substance use, is that if you're alcohol dependent, you have to drink. you have to stop yourself going into DTs. Mm. So offer people early morning appointments,
okay,
where they'll have had enough to get up and function,
yeah,
but they won't be intoxicated.
Good tip.
It was the opposite with drug misuse. They yeah. tended to appreciate afternoon appointments because they had to source out the things they needed to get to a point where they could function.
I see.
But I think if you've got a patient that continually comes in intoxicated, I mean, certainly I would take him aside from the waiting area,
mm-hmm.
Maybe not necessarily into the consultation room, because you do need to look at risk and you've got to think about how you end that conversation,
mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
that's down to you.
Yeah.
But somewhere quiet and somewhere private and say, I think you've sort of overjudged yourself today, potentially, mm-hmm. But you are intoxicated. I think we'd both be wasting our time. So again, it's sharing that, you know, you're yeah. wasting your time, I'm wasting your time.
Yeah.
And put back to them, would there be a time in the week when you could come and see me and this risk would be less?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll often find that will be the morning. And then when you do get that person in, just have a conversation about it. Be open and say, you know, you were at the surgery really quite intoxicated last week. What happened? Mm-hmm. And how is that making you feel?
Mm-hmm.
Because that, again, when we talk about sort of brief interventions, can be a real trigger for someone to say, actually, when I got home and I realised I can't even go to my GP without being drunk, that yeah. I really need help. I've really stepped into some dark areas.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's very helpful. I think that's quite clear that it's okay to sort of politely and kindly not engage immediately when someone's intoxicated, but to then offer follow-up and ideally a sort of morning appointment.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the end of the day, from a kind of medical legal point of view, you can't really be getting informed consent of a patient who's intoxicated.
True.
So, and I actually have said that to patients. I've said, look, you know, we could come up with a treatment plan and I could refer you here, but you're intoxicated and you're not making a fully informed choice, and that isn't something I'm comfy with today.
Yeah, okay, that's very helpful. I think the only other sort of scenario I wanted to talk past you is I find it quite tricky to really encourage a certain subset of patients to go to Turning Point, for example. That's where we would signpost mm-hmm. folk to. And it's frustrating that there's no longer community outreach. We used to have a very good community outreach worker, which did seem to make a difference, because he would meet patients sort of at their home or in a coffee shop or for a walk in their local area, and it just took away that barrier of access of getting yourself to a drop-in. I'm sort of slightly at a loss. I mean, I just keep trying to suggest it and I keep offering a bit of a relationship with myself. But, you know, what to do when you can't get someone to engage with the third sector that we're being told to get them to engage with?
I mean, it is frustrating, it is difficult. But I do think services do create barriers
yeah.
at times. We talk about, you know, some of these organisations being quite overtly labelled.
Mm.
So you're obviously going into the drug and alcohol centre.
Exactly.
That can be a real barrier, which actually was one of the impetus for the model of embedding primary care mental health nurses into general practice.
Okay.
Because you're coming to see your GP. We don't have signs on the door saying mental health nurse.
Yes.
And we definitely see a lot of people who would never engage in secondary care or third sector.
Yeah.
So actually maybe exploring that
mm-hmm.
with a patient, certainly in Edinburgh, and I know there is a national program, but it might be a good place to think about a link worker.
Mm-hmm.
So they would be actually able to go with them
mm-hmm.
if it's more about getting over the door.
Yeah.
And we all experience that, you know, with new things,
yes.
you know, going to your first step class, etc.
Yes, exactly.
You know, going through the door. So we all understand that. And again, being really open and honest with a patient about, you know, I don't struggle with alcohol, but I remember I needed to lose weight and I needed to go to an exercise class and I kept putting it off. And so you're bringing it down to their level.
Yeah.
And actually just exploring, maybe they're just not ready yet. They're not at that level yet, but it doesn't mean you can't be doing other work. And I think the frustration can be reduced if you started with somebody on that conversation on a goal that's meaningful for them.
Yes.
Because if you've had a conversation and come away with a theory of abstinence and then a set of treatment, you're bashing your head against a brick wall.
Yes, I see that this is yet again my doctor-led agenda where I'm thinking, I've got to get them to turning point. And so again, I think that key message that you're giving me and all of us listening is start with a goal that the patient maybe identifies for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had one lady who wanted not to drink before 12 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. That was a start. So mm-hmm. she needed to work with that, did not want to detox, so we had to look around the safety of that as well. And she wanted to be able to get to the shops and get her shopping and get home and have a cup of tea before she had a drink. And that's where we started.
Okay.
Now that lady many years ago is abstinent and she's actually quite vocal in terms of mutual aid.
Yeah.
But she had to start somewhere, and once she got that feeling of success and small win, she took herself off. She didn't need me.
I think that's so helpful to hear, Kat. I think that's what we need to hear. I've got one other question. You know, I'm kind of curious what happens at turning point, how people do support my patients. Mm-hmm. Had one patient who, for example, seemed to have quite a clear escalation plan made with their support worker, you know, like what to do next time you're tempted, kind of thing. Is that the kind of thing that goes on? Should we understand a bit more about that as GPs, or, you know, what can we know about that?
I mean, certainly I teach on the RCGP, working with drug users course. Mm. So I have a cohort across the Central Belt of GPs and MDTs every year.
Mm.
And one of the things we suggest is doing field visits, which is difficult, I know, a short time, but it actually is good to be able to have a visual of the service that you are signposting to,
yep.
especially ones that carry stigma.
Yep.
So being able to say, look, it wasn't obvious I was going in there. The staff were really friendly.
Yes.
I was taken into a private room. You know, I think it's really important for those particular services if you can get out and do a little bit of a field visit. But yes, they're the therapeutic arm, so they're not medical.
Yeah.
In some areas, they might do the workup for a inpatient detox. But they won't be doing any prescribing, any sort of community detoxes or ant abuse. But they may work with their NHS colleagues and do that. But they very much and always have, and we're being led by them, I think. They'll look at what that person is wanting to do. What are their goals? What would they like to work on? Is it a controlled drinking plan? Is it an abstinence plan? And then they'll work on a relapse prevention plan. So that's a bit what you're talking about. Mm. So what are the high risk situations? When am I most likely to drink or to break my goal? And it could be a person, it could be an area, it could be a point in the week, it could be a date in the year.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually looking at a support plan. Is it about avoiding that place? Sometimes people have to disconnect from relationships and that can be hard.
Mm.
Or it might be being boundaried with somebody. So sometimes we even talk about, let's just role play. You're in the pub and you're getting pressure and somebody says, it's Friday night, why on earth would you not want a drink? Mm-hmm. Let's just role play it out. Tell me.
Interesting.
That's actually a really good piece of work to do with people.
Okay.
Because we've not really touched upon it, but I don't think it's Scotland necessarily, but actually it's quite hard to be sober.
It is. You know, people, in our society.
Yeah, everything we do is focused around having a drink.
Yeah.
You know, people being born and getting married to people passing away.
Yeah,
you know?
All our rituals.
Yep, absolutely. So I think it's also saying to that person, be prepared to be not criticised, but people will say some things that might feel quite hurtful and it's cultural.
Mm.
And actually having the confidence to say it's a personal choice and it's not really up for discussion. So giving people the permission to rehearse that sort of stuff.
Okay.
So they do all that in Turning Point.
Yeah.
It's not to say you couldn't do that in a consult
mm-hmm.
over time. Mm-hmm. You'd have to sort of do it in bite-sized chunks
yeah.
if they wouldn't go.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the sort of thing you expect.
The other thing that I heard a patient tell me is this concept of urge surfing that mm-hmm. Their support worker told them about. Can you tell us what urge surfing is?
Yes, so it's a really good relapse prevention technique, and I think it was first used for people who self-harmed. So it's been around for quite a while, but it is embedded in neuroscience and the peaks and troughs of dopamine.
Okay.
So the urge surfing is you get a person to imagine that they are on a surfboard.
Right.
and they're hitting the crest of a wave, and that's the craving. Now, what we know is if you can stay on that surfboard and ride those waves
mm-hmm.
for a 20-minute period, you will come into the beach safely. And that's the same with cravings.
Oh.
So another thing that we sometimes hear is the sort of urge surfing in 20 minutes, or the 15-minute rule
mm-hmm.
is another one that I say to patients. Even if they said, I don't want to drink before 8 o'clock at night, it's 6 o'clock, I'm craving. Right, what are you going to do for 15 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
How are you feeling? So checking back in, still craving, do something else for 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're bite-sized times that we can fill.
Yes. So, like, if you manage to distract yourself for 15 minutes, there's a chance that the urge will have lessened.
Yep. And if it hasn't, then just keep going. But
okay.
We know that cravings are not consistent. They're not with you all the time.
No, that's true.
They will be if you think about them all the time.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's where the distraction comes in.
Yeah.
You know, make yourself a cup of tea, go out into the garden,
yeah.
ring a friend. The Reframe app actually has all these games that you can play, like Tetris and stuff.
Okay.
And it has a 15-minute timer.
Yeah,
so
okay.
You actually choose a game, you do that for 15 minutes, and then you check back in.
Got you. I think it's quite helpful to be able to give that advice with an underlying neuroscience
mm-hmm,
reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I say, oh, just distract yourself, it's not as powerful as saying, we know that your dopamine urge will be usually about 20 minutes. You know, I think that that gives a lot more weight to the advice.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the same when I've done my trauma work, when we talk about the neuroscience around toxic stress and the impact. It really is quite powerful for patients to hear that. You're right. I think you do need to be specific.
Mm.
It's like saying to someone who's having a panic attack, breathe.
You
know? Yeah. It's not very helpful,
no,
is it?
No. Yeah. I think that something about getting physiological
mm-hmm.
makes it slightly less sort of personal and shameful, if that makes
and
sense.
Maybe a bit more credible.
A bit more credible, a bit more scientific.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
I think that's really helpful. Kat, we're almost out of time. Is there anything that you would sort of like to leave our chat with, you know, that you think is a key message you would want folk like me trying to improve our everyday conversations?
I think the takeaway message for me working in primary care is if somebody comes to you or they admit in a consult that they're struggling with their alcohol use, then that is a massively major step. And it's really important that you recognise that.
Okay.
But with real conviction.
Okay.
So you don't say, oh, it's fantastic you said that, and then leap straight to, this is how we fix it.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's really important. And then it's actually sitting down with someone and saying, where would you like to start?
Okay.
And I certainly say, is there a bit about your drinking you'd like to tackle first? Is
mm-hmm.
there something that's causing you more distress or harm? Let's just pick a little bit off and let's start working.
Oh, thank you, Kat. That's incredibly helpful and does seem a little bit more manageable as well. So thank you very much for joining me, and I hope everyone else finds this as helpful as I certainly have.
No problem. Nice to speak.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Conversations About Alcohol. Be sure to follow and like the podcast to be updated when new episodes are released.